My name is Bill Grace, and this is my second week at Holden. I see some familiar faces here. I'm going to be doing four more sessions this week, and I've just outlined them briefly on the board here. Today we're going to talk about American culture, addiction to oppression, We're going to take a look at that question. Last week, for those of you who are here, you know that I was focusing on leadership and ethics and some of the isms, racism and sexism, with the notion, if we do live in a society that is oppressing people, how do we begin to break that cycle of oppression? How do we begin to heal that? And one of the beliefs I have is that service, we can connect that to our understanding of scripture, the healing balm of service. I would like to begin to kind of start ride a bit more of an optimistic crest as we come towards the end of the week. After the next session on service, the third session will be taking a look at two paradigms or two models about how and the ways in which we understand ourselves as a culture. And the two models we're going to look at, or two paradigms, are lifeboat versus spaceship Earth ethics. We're going to be taking a look at the difference between those ethics within those paradigms, and talk about how each of those ethics might affect the way in which we see the world and therefore act in the world. And then finally, we're going to take a look at, on Saturday morning, what would an American perestroika look like? Kind of the notion of cleaning up our own backyard. Today I'd like to start, though, by really asking a question. And here's the question, and I'm going to ask you to do some work in groups today, two different times. The question, let me pose it to you. Is American lifestyle dependent on a permanent underclass? If so, then are we as Americans addicted to oppression? And our dependency would be then, therefore, on a permanent underclass. And what I'd like to do is to ask you, with the help of a couple resources I'm going to pass around, but to use your own experiences as well. I'll be sitting around two different sheets. They look very much alike, but they're different, so keep an eye out to get both copies. Let me just quote a few statistics. This is from a center in New York City against racism and sexism, and they try to collect statistical information that represents the problem. One of the statistics has to do with unemployment rates, connecting that to race and age. The unemployment rate for whites in 1984 was 6.4%. For blacks, it was 15.8%. For Hispanics, 10.5%. For white teenagers, this is interesting, 16.2%. For black teenagers, 44.1%. Let me just make one brief connection. Unemployed youth at that rate, does that have anything to do with the development of gangs? Does that have anything to do with the number of youth of color involved in selling crack cocaine? Just a question. How do the systems that oppress perpetuate destructive lifestyles among the poor? Let me give you one other one. How there's been no improvement between the ratio of black and white employment from 1960 to the present. In 1960, the blacks earned 0.55 of what the average white citizen earned. In 1975, that rose to 0.62, and as of 1982, it's back to 0.55, and as of 90, as I understand it, it's now 0.53. So the ratio, if we take a look at dollars, if a white person is earning a dollar, for that dollar, the average person of color is now earning 53 cents. And it's actually gotten worse since 1960. So those are just two examples. And yes?
Can I ask a question about that statistic? Does that include the people that are on welfare, unemployed, as well as people that are working? Is that the average? Is that the average of all people?
I understand your question, and I the statistic here, the table isn't clear as to which that represents. Let me pass this around, and what I want you to do are three things. First of all, individually, I'd like you to look at these sheets, just peruse them. I'm going to give you a couple minutes to do that. Then I'd like you to begin to think about America historically. from the time the Pilgrims first landed, the ways in which we've treated Native Americans, the ways in which we've treated women, children, people of color. I'd like you to think, if my proposition is true, that American lifestyle is dependent on oppression, then we ought to put together very easily a kind of a tapestry of oppression throughout our history. Question first.
Actually, I want to respond. I don't know what that data is based on, but almost all of that data, wherever you see it, is based on unearned income. It may reflect people who are only employed part-time. It isn't transformed to an hourly comparison. But any of the data that you see, for say, between men and women and so on, is always done based on employment and not on like household income. So I expect that's a wage difference, not a...
I think you're right.
Not a family income difference. So you're not getting the teenage welfare mother's income in there at all. That's people who are working.
So the three things I'd like you to do are this. One is to begin to look at these sheets to kind of prime the well a little bit. Then I'd like you to turn to at least maybe let's say two other people around you so that in groups of three she'll be talking about examples that you can recall from American history about how the privileged in our culture have lived that lifestyle on the backs of others. And then for us to, the third thing would be for us to report back and talk to each other about those stories. And I'm going to give you about 10 minutes for this first individual and small group exercise. One of the fact sheets will go this way. The other one will go this way. Give copies of both. If you want to begin talking to your neighbor right away, that's fine too. But I'll give you 10 minutes to begin that. What I'd like to do, a couple more things. Someone asked, is the rest of the session going to be this much fun? There will be another chance for us to get back into these same groups if you'd like. What I'd like to do now is just to spend a few minutes building a stage, if you will, for what I hope will be the meat of the discussion in the next 20 minutes. And the stage has to do with my hypothesis, really, which I stated at the beginning of the session, which was, is American lifestyle dependent on a permanent underclass? And if so, we ought to be able to put together a weaving, a tapestry through American history of how the affluent have led that lifestyle based on the backs of different peoples who have been oppressed. And so what I'd like to do now is to hear, first of all, any reactions you might have had in your small group to the statistics, but more so, what examples did you come up with in your small group about how American lifestyle is really dependent on and based on the oppression of others?
I don't like that word, oppression. The employer gives the employee opportunity to work, and if the employee has any sense, he will save a couple cents out of each dollar, no matter how little, and better himself.
Any reactions, Dan?
Well, I can give one historical example where the person required to work didn't have an opportunity to save, and that would be slavery. The Africans who were brought here, I think much of the capital wealth of this country was built on slavery. And there was no opportunity for the Africans to save any money or to advance their position. So there's one, from my perspective, one concrete example where that would indeed be oppression. There was no employment opportunity.
I know. I was reared. I had a tough time in the 30s, but time heals everything.
Okay. In the back here.
I think that we need to go back one step further to the acquisition of the land and wealth and resources in the North American continent, which was basically taken from the indigenous people who were
okay.
all here. So we first acquired the land and the mineral wealth, and then we tilled it with slave labor. And we've got some more bits of mail that might go on.
Well, there's interesting word imagery that happens too, because we really didn't take the land away from Native Americans, we took the land away from the savages, and you know. Yes.
Also, if we go further forward in history, in the late 1800s, early 1900s, the wealth of people like the Vanderbilts, etc., was built upon laborers who were children working at 5 or 6 years of age.
All right.
Yeah, but it also takes It takes money to develop and provide opportunity.
Okay. Let's not just try to make this a one or two person debate. Let's try to keep the discussion going. Yeah, right here.
I would like to make it to the present. We can't do anything about the past, but we can do something about the present and the future.
Thank you. And I hope that that's going to be the direction for the discussion in the next 20 minutes. But I'd just like to spend a little bit more time, if we could, talking about the history. This is uncomfortable stuff. It typically makes a lot of us feel guilty. That's not why I'm doing it, but I think it's also important to name this stuff. Dan, and then down here.
As we approach that future discussion about how we can redistribute capital, it's still so important to remember that in order for our system to work, there has to be that massive capital. And in the beginning, what allowed the Industrial Revolution to happen in those Western European countries was the New World and just, you know, all that gold and silver that was being taken out of what's now Latin America. And, you know, Europe was able to amass a huge amount of capital, which then was put into forming a new society, which we as the white people have inherited in North America.
Great point. And I hope to talk a little bit more about that later in the week when we start talking about paradigms. One of the paradigms that's shifting is the 200 to 300 year old notion of expansionism. That had a lot to do with the ways in which we came into the Western world, the belief that this was the new world, it was open territory, it didn't belong to anybody, and it was there for the taking, there for the first arrivals. And expansionism is a paradigm that's not helpful to us anymore. We need to begin to replace the paradigm of expansionism with something else. And we're going to talk some more about that on Thursday, here and then here.
Harold List concluded things like, originally this country was settled by a lot of indentured servants who came over and had to earn their passage by working as a slave, but they were typically white. We also mentioned the female rights that was quite small in this country. In fact, they didn't get the voting rights until the 20s, wasn't it?
That's an excellent point. If we take a look at voting rights, you know, we like to think, yeah, that's right. We talk about America, you know, where everyone is created equal and everybody had the right to vote, especially if you were a white male property owner. And then we take a look at white males, even if you're not a property owner, and then blacks, but black males. But then we have poll tax, which keeps blacks and poor whites from being able to vote. And then finally, after blacks are given the right to vote, then about 30, 35 years later, then women are given a right to vote. And then finally, because youth are saying, if we have to die in Vietnam, can't we have something to say about our government, then we give young adults the right to vote. But it's a slow process of giving over authority in a culture that really tries to control resources. Here.
Just want to say that I haven't moved to California about 20 years ago, led me to realize how oppressed the Chinese were in San Francisco, Northern California, in the early part of this century, even into the middle part of this century.
Let's just take two more, and then we're going to move on. Upstairs and then down here.
I'm just going to give one very recent example. In the past 5 years, Latin America has shipped a net of about $180 billion in capital transfers two northern countries, including the United States, just paying interest on the debt.
Okay.
So the debt is a new vehicle of capital accumulation.
One of the things that Jack named for me the other day was, I've always struggled with the notion of the third world, not liking that term, and he calls it the two-thirds world. And one of the new systems that we're oppressing in the last 20, 30 years is the two-thirds world. American lifestyle is now dependent on, you know, oppressing people beyond our boundaries on a daily basis. Here,
and then I'm thinking about the composition of the laborers that have fueled the industrial system, like the railroads going from coast to coast with the Chinese who were brought over to work on the railroads, and that includes a lot of other minorities also, and women also and children that have fueled that system and actually made the money without reaping any particular reward from it.
I think that it's not something I do every day, you know, to get up in the morning and to kind of weave this tapestry of pain and suffering upon which my lifestyle is built. It's not something that I take a lot of pleasure in, but I think it's important for us to do that on occasions like this, when we're asking questions that might change the way in which we view the world and therefore participate in the world, I think it is important to spend some time dwelling on these things, as painful as they might be, because the point is that the lifestyle that we have in the States is creating a great deal of pain and misery in the lives of others now and historically. And there's no indication that that's going to stop. There's no indication that out there somewhere is a means by which we can have this lifestyle without oppressing someone. It appears that the affluence that we have come to know and love and welcome really comes to us based on the pain and suffering of others. And we need to spend some time dwelling on that. But I would not like to spend the whole time dwelling on that, so let me move us on to another set of questions I'd like us to discuss. Now, the glare from this podium makes it difficult to read sometimes. Can most people see that? Okay. I'd like to start, and some of you who are in a session that I did a couple days ago are familiar with this diamond model, as I call it, but I'd like to just review it real quickly for those of you who aren't. The diamond model belongs to, or was developed by a guy named Robert Terry, who works at the Hubert Humphrey Institute in Minnesota. And it's his belief that all institutions are based on four components: mission, power, structure, and resources. And he says if we want to do an institutional analysis of any institution, Holden Village, the place where you might work at home, but for now, if we were to use this to examine the American culture, we need to ask ourselves, who developed the mission of the American culture? Give me a color and a gender.
White
males. Think about the founding fathers and try to picture people of color in that room, and women. Power. Who controls the power in this country? White males. Structure. Structure is the vehicle through which things happen. Policies and procedures, bills of rights, constitutions. Who created those in this culture? White males. And who controls the resources in this country? White males. This is what Bob Terry calls a club, and it is in fact the white male club.
Who developed computers?
Who did?
Men.
Elaborate on your point a little bit more.
Well, development is not passé. We still have to have brains and capital with which to proceed to improve. We don't want to go back and forget about computers or automobiles.
In your model, is the progress that you're talking about dependent on the suffering of others?
To a certain extent, yes. Can't avoid it. If they allow themselves to suffer, if they're in a position where that's necessary.
Why don't we hang on to that comment until we get into our small groups, and let's pick up that again when we come back. Because I'd like to get you back to the fun part, as someone mentioned over here. I'd like us to consider this model, if you would, that we live in a country whose mission, power, structure, and resources are ultimately controlled by white men. And if anyone would like to talk further, I can suggest a number of things for you to read and consult to demonstrate to you the myriad of examples that would prove that this is indeed the case today. Even though we see more women and more people of color in the system, the bottom line is that my belief is, and I can point you to literature that would support it, that this is indeed the case. What I'd like to do in small groups now is to address each of these five questions, and I'm going to give you 15 minutes to do that. First of all, do you believe, this should be, that on a daily basis the American culture oppresses women, people of color, gays and lesbians, children, and members of the two-thirds world? First of all, to talk about in your small group, do you believe that? Secondly, do you believe that there is somehow a connection between affluence and oppression? In order for one set of people in this world to be affluent, it's typically based on the oppression of others. Then assuming you would like that to change, what would it cost us to stop the oppression? How would, for instance, American lifestyle be different? How would it cost you personally if that oppression were to stop? If that oppression did stop, on the other side of that coin, what might you gain? And the fifth question, we're going to save to the end of the discussion. I'm going to ask individuals to think about what's one thing you'll do, first of all, if you believe this is a problem, and secondly, you'd like to do something about it. What is one thing you'll do when you get back to your church, community, home, to see that your affluence is not based on the oppression of others? So go back to those groups if you'd like, form new groups if you like, have some fun, and again give you 15 minutes and then get back for a discussion. Try to do is spend a little bit of time in the first two questions and more time on the ones on the board numbered 3, 4, and 5, but we're going to save 5 to a little later on in the discussion. So first of all, just general consensus, let me hear some of the ideas that came up in the group. Let's all hear them. Do you believe that on a daily basis that the American culture oppresses women, people of color, gays, lesbians, and people in the two-thirds world? What were some of the ideas from groups?
Well,
Dan?
I think it's really important in your diamond model to add heterosexual to the white male domination.
Okay.
Because we can't envision a future solution unless we see that as part of the problem, because sexism and heterosexism work simultaneously. You can't separate them, because we can see how women are oppressed by sexism, but so are men. And the way that patriarchy oppresses men is that it's essential that men dominate women. And if men are not aggressive and oppressive and dominating, how that's reinforced is that from a very early age, they are queers, homos, faggots. A lot of control, social control, goes into making sure that men are aggressive and oppressive and dominating. Any male who does not do that is oppressed and marginalized.
I think Dan's point is excellent and a real important one for especially white men in the room to consider. How does our homophobia, fear of being labeled homosexual, keep us from learning how to be caregivers to one another, to develop that feminine side, that nurturing side of ourselves, so that we have more choices other than the ones that our culture has given us, to be the ultimate male is to kind of look like John Wayne and ride like him and talk like him, and that there's other choices. And I think that men, Chuck and I have had a couple conversations since I've been in the village about how in his life he's rediscovering the feminine. And I think that's an important piece for all of us. And I would agree with Dan that the model ought to be labeled the heterosexual white male dominance.
I guess I just have one point with regard to homosexuality. I agree there's still oppression, but I see so many changes in the last 10 years, because when I was growing up, I would go to parties, and it was perfectly polite to laugh about gay people, and I participated in jokes about gay people, and that was socially acceptable, and it isn't anymore. You can't go to a party with a group of people and make gay jokes anymore, so that's at least some improvement.
Where do you live?
Let me bring us back to the first question again. First, do we believe that on a daily basis that the American lifestyle, the American culture, oppresses women, people of color, gays and lesbians, people in the two-thirds world? What did your groups come up with? Yeah. Right here.
Yes or no. I use the one example that place where I work. They're giving a lot of precedent to hiring blacks, minorities, women over white males these days. They have better training programs. In fact, I have seen notices come out. Be sure and plan a training program for your minorities and women in your groups.
Who's planning the training programs?
the different departments, different groups. We have training department.
So you're.
But I just wonder. Is it the white men that are planning the training?
White men that are in charge. Some, no, not necessarily. No, I thought women trainers.
I'm just curious.
The other thing that I mentioned too is that I talked to a young, related to us, who's in med school. He's on the board of admissions of a med school, and he says that the schools are admitting with less qualifications the minorities and the women to med school, which makes you think. Now, if I were going to pick a young doctor, I'd pick a white male young doctor because he's better qualified than the average black young doctor or minority or woman because they're admitted with lower qualifications.
Let's stop and take a look at that.
So oppression is, it's a bad word. There's opportunity in America too for people like that, more so than white males today.
Let's stop and take a look at that point because I find that to happen quite often, that when we begin to talk about the oppression of those people in the culture who have been historically mistreated, what tends to happen, and you differ if you'd like, but my experience over the last dozen years as I've observed this is that when we begin to talk about systems that are being invoked to change structures that are oppressed, they typically cause white males to react defensively and to begin to name things like reverse discrimination. And I think that's what you're talking about. But those statistics that you're quoting need to be seen in the context of some other statistics, and that is to be a black male in this country today means that a black male between the ages of 18 and 25 is more likely to go to jail than they are to go to college. What's wrong with the culture that causes that to be the case? Now, if we begin to open up admissions requirements in order to turn that around, do we continue to be oppressors if we call that reverse discrimination? You know, because we're going to be getting into that. We do have to intentionally change systems, because how else do you break into the cycle of poverty? How else do you break into the cycle of oppression? But that is an understandable, and I really do want to say I understand the reaction, but I think it's not a helpful reaction, because it typically, it ultimately is intended to keep people of color right exactly where they are.
I don't agree with that. Okay. As long as they're equal is fine, but when they're given priority, when they're hired or admitted to medical school with lower qualifications,
I want to go upstairs here, Meredith, and then down here.
Yeah. I just wanted to comment on that, because the idea of admittance into whether it's college or medical school or law school is a real crucial issue. And so often, though, the things that we have established as the criteria for admission themselves are not, one, useful, and two, very racially and sexually biased. For example, the SATs or the MCATs, which is the medical school admission test, have no relation to people's success in medicine or in college. That's been documented for a long time. And so, while I understand what you're saying, you know, from a layperson's perspective, those people are less qualified. But in the reality of what their success will be in medicine or in college, those tests are irrelevant. The SAT is all they show is what your grades will be your first year in college. I mean, you know, they were normed on a very small white male population. And so I think we need to get beyond some of these things we talk about and get back to the real structural issues of admin.
Thanks, Mary.
Yeah, I just reinforce the point. I understand your anecdote, and you can believe that if you want. I work in healthcare administration, and it is absolutely true that it's much harder, because it's much harder for women and blacks to make it through medical school, to get in, A, and make it through. The healthcare system that I work with, which is the largest in the country, looks for women and blacks because they're going to be more qualified, because they've had to fight against much harder odds in being successful in those environments. So I don't know what medical school you're talking about, but the system that I work with has no problem hiring women or blacks to be physicians, and our patients have no problem going to see them because they find that they get a lot better care in general we have higher satisfaction statistics, we have higher quality statistics for women and black physicians.
Let's move a little bit away from the reverse discrimination debate, because I think it's a tough one to come to conclusion on, although I want to make it real clear to all of you that from my perspective, it's a reaction to the initial attempts to ask white males not to give up their rights, but to ask white males to give up their privileges. And I'm not asking white males to give up their rights, but I am asking white males in my own life to give up their privileges. And reverse discrimination is an understandable initial reaction, but one I think that we need to get beyond for the sake of the culture. I'd like to get to this, to the first question that's on the board. Just in general, do you think that there is a connection between American affluence and oppression? Is American culture and what we know as affluent Americans, is our lifestyle based on the oppression of others? Do you draw those connections, or do you not accept them? Jan?
Absolutely. My simple yes or no answer to that question, yes.
The figures that you brought up the other night on Friday, you know, is that U.S. is 5% of the world's population, but we consume 40-45% of the world's resources.
Yeah.
There's a connection there.
One of the other statistics that I think is real compelling, and cultural issues, I guess, are my own strongest interest, so I tend to follow these statistics pretty closely. The most disturbing one that I've come across lately on National Public Radio, cited about a month ago, and I have not got a copy of the study yet, indicated that if you consider all of the blacks living, African Americans living in the United States, and were to consider how many are connected to the court system in one way or another, meaning that they're either, their trial is pending, or currently on trial, or on probation, or incarcerated, or, you know, or death row, what percentage would you think of black Americans are in that predicament in the country?
What percentage of people in that predicament are black?
No, what percentage of black Americans in this culture are connected to one of those aspects of the court system that I just named?
I heard a statistic on black youths.
This is blacks in general.
It's black men, isn't it, Bill?
Black men, yeah. Thanks, Dan.
Can you give us the number in general?
It's 25%.
One out of four.
What's the number of all of the population? What's the percentage of it?
10% of the U.S.
You're asking what percentage are black, are African Americans a part of the U.S. population?
No, what percentage of all Americans are involved in the system?
Yeah, I don't know, but the point I guess I'm making is that of black men, one-fourth of black men in this country are in some ways connected to the court system. I have to ask, what's wrong with the culture?
I don't think you can ask that question until you find out if other members of the same male in this country, what their statistics are. Maybe the white male or the Hispanic is 24%, so what's the difference? You can't.
I can assure you it's much less for white males.
It's about 2%.
Much less. One-tenth, one-fifth, something like that.
Yeah.
I think that we do conclusions on that first one, that there certainly is a connection both in the global community and in the national community. And another statistic that was mentioned was infant mortality in the United States,
okay,
which is kind of similar to your people in the criminal justice system.
Great. Right here.
I think it may go back to their family life. My husband has taught in a black community, black schools, and they're run by a woman, and the male is gone, and they have no...
Let's take a look at that question, if we would, and I want to take a look at that question in terms of systematic oppression. the question is, and I think you were leading to, you know, maybe one of the reasons why youth are going into jail is because of the disruption of the family. And as we view black families in this culture, we typically view them as the mother present and the father not present. Some alarming statistics in the last 2 years ago, in 1 year, there were 700,000 new black families on in the poverty ranks. 700,000 new black families in the poverty ranks in 1 year, 2 years ago. During that same year, just so happened that 700,000 African-American males were unemployed. Can a woman get ADC while her spouse is living with her?
Some states, yes.
Some states, yes. The predominant answer to that question in this culture is no. If you take a look at states like New York or Massachusetts, where I grew up, if a black male is unemployed, and if black male unemployment rates are higher than white males, if that person's spouse and children are to get aid for the dependent children, the male cannot live in the household. So how are we systematically disrupting the African-American family and participating in the creation of the cycle of poverty? Dan?
Well, you know, one thing I think is a little hard about this question, at least for me, the way I was raised in this country, it's easier for me to acknowledge that oppression or discrimination exists. It's harder for me to make the connections between my affluence being connected to the oppression of others. And that's why I thought it was really helpful when we started out with historical examples, because I think one of the ways that I grew up is, I think oftentimes as people in this country, we have very short historical memories. And so we when we look at a problem, we look at it as it exists right now. We can all look at the statistics of what's going on right now. It's a lot harder, are we not as disciplined at looking at the roots of that, what historically has happened to bring us up to this situation. And I don't think we can make the connections between affluence and oppression without, you know, like we did at the beginning, examining some of the historical roots of. For me, it's been a real learning experience being back in New York City and having lots of African Americans in my school, because they point out that they spent their ancestors spent 250 years with no recompense building up the capital of this country, and then at the end of the Civil War, they were given freedom in one sense, but with absolutely no economic redressing of that investment in the capital. And so what happened was the vast majority of African Americans plunged into immediate poverty. They lost the security of the plantation system with no economic reward. And so they had this historical heritage of, and started off so far behind everyone else in society that historical heritage makes that connection between the affluence and the oppression.
Excellent point. Meredith?
Well, I think in expanding on what he said, I think just for most of us in society today, if we have middle-class black friends, their financial situation, even if they're making the same salary as we are, is usually quite different. Most of us, if things really got bad, could go home and our parents could help out a little bit, or to varying degrees. Most middle-class black families, you know, they always say they're one or two paychecks away from welfare or from homelessness. And I think taking what Dan said to a present-day example, you know, that's the way it is for most of us.
I see that I can't believe how quickly the hour goes by, and we're closing in on a point where I guess I'd like to make a slight shift in in where we're headed. We'd like to do that, though, by just talking briefly about a concept of that I call the myth of expert, and would just like to talk to you about how we've created this concept of expert in our culture, and I would just like to demystify that a little bit in relation to some of these ethical questions. If you find yourself resisting the information a little bit, is our affluence somehow connected to the oppression of others? First of all, I would encourage you to not be surprised at that. I think that's a normal human reaction. We don't like to see ourselves as the pain givers to others, and don't be hard on yourself. But I would ask you to do this, to prayerfully reflect on that question, and to do so after you take away what I call the myth of expert. Here's the myth of expert. We live in a complex society, And I'm led to believe that if I have some feelings about the way things ought to run in South Africa and I have an opinion, there might be someone who attempts to silence me but says, well, Bill, you know, you're really not a multinational economist, and if you really understood what it would do to the, you know, to the global economy if we dismantled apartheid overnight, you know, we really need to go about this slowly, and if you only understood multinational economics, you'd understand, so, you know, why don't you go study that for a few years and then make a rational opinion. My response to that is that that's an expert opinion, but there's also some myth in there, because I know in my heart of hearts that apartheid spits in the face of the gospel. I know that preparation for nuclear war in my gut is madness. I know that the systematic abuse of people based on the color of their skin is wrong, and that if Christ were standing in this room, that he would be nodding his head right now. I ask you to search this out not based on statistics, not by listening to experts, but to consider the history, to consider the current dilemmas that we're facing as a culture, and to prayerfully reflect on what I think are some ethical questions that we reduce to statistics sometimes to try to make points. But I really do believe that ultimate commitment to change, which is what I'd like to talk about next, is based on a leap of faith. Because we could have an argument all day as to why reverse discrimination is the case or why it's not the case, and might not make a lot of progress. I really do believe it's a leap of faith, and I encourage you to prayerfully consult that, and your leap of faith may be different than mine, and that's fine, but encourage you to consult the question on that level. I'd like to read something and then get to the final question. Robert Terry is a person who I have a great deal of respect for. He spent a lot of time considering how our current culture, our current structures oppress people of color. And he's been a consultant in the field for a number of years, and I've learned a great deal from him. I shared this story last week, so it might be repetitious to a couple of you who I see who were in the village last week. Bob Terry was asked to do a forum on racism, actually reducing racism for a city in Minnesota. And the city council had invited him in, and they gathered the leaders of the city for the forum. They wanted to know how to reduce the level of racism in their city, and so he gave them what was at first a surprising task for them. He said, if you want to know how to be a non-racist city, the first thing you need to know is how to be a racist city. So that's what he asked them to do, first of all, was to intentionally create a racist society. Two things they discovered. Number one, the task was easier than they had first imagined. And then secondly, without intentionally planning it, the final product clearly resembled their own white community. Here's what they did. Whites kept the power privileges. Whites secured community benefits. Whites maintained ethnocentrism, meaning that white was normal. And whites continued the myth that blacks or other people of color were the problem race. If they only. This is what the group concluded that the church should do, and every time I read this, it breaks my heart. And I'd like to read it to you now and then end with a challenge. This is the role they felt that the church should play. To create a racist community. Thank you. What role should the churches play? Conclusion. They should not publicly denounce people of color, except if they challenge the white church structure directly, like the Black Manifesto. They should maintain a public posture of non-racism and color indifference. Some of my best friends are black. However, in no way should the church members aggressively organize to change the church itself or challenge the implicit assumptions that whites should control decisions, access, and standards. As a matter of fact, it would be good to occasionally have instruction on race, so long as nothing substantively changed. And my fear is that that's what Holden Village can be about. We come up into the mountains, and for a week or a few days, we talk about how things could be different when we go home. And we all feel better about it because we had this kind of cathartic experience, and imagine a world that might be different. And if we go home and do nothing, we do nothing but perpetuate the problems that exist. So ending on this last question is really important for me, and I'd just like to hear from a few of you if you got that far. If you believe that your affluence is somehow based on the oppression of others, what's something you'll do when you go home? And I have to start by saying one of the things I do is to offer to give these talks as often as possible free of charge.